everybody. This is your Game Life podcast for Friday, October 24th. Hello, hi, I'm Chris Kohler, the host of the Game Life podcast here at The Wired, and with me here in the studio is...
Peter Rubin, senior editor at Wired, and rounding out the room is not our usual beau, but it is a guest who harkens?
Long-time listeners will know the dulcet tones.
This is Chris Baker. A.K.A. Wired's Angry Nerd.
Wired's Angry Nerd, a video series you can watch now on video.wired.com?
No, watch it on YouTube.
Oh, yeah? Watch it on YouTube?
You can watch it on YouTube. And you can follow me, Angry Nerd Wired, all one word, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Vine, and on YouTube, on Google Plus. I came here to talk to you guys, though.
I didn't come here to flout. Chill.
Social media profile, Angry Nerd Wired.
Have you completely dissociated your screen alter ego from your, like, is it like a personal versus a fan page on Facebook now? Or is the real Chris Baker still a valid portal into your thoughts?
It's like Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, or have you been subsumed?
I've been staging... And no one seems to find this funny but me.
I've been staging
pitched arguments between my personal Twitter account, which, by the way, is Chris Baker 1337, Chris Baker Lead, and my Angry Nerd Twitter account, which, as I believe I might have said, is Angry Nerd Wired.
Angry Nerd Wired, all one word.
And how is brand awareness going?
Brand awareness is it's always a work in progress. Put it this way, I'm so desperate to build my brand identity that I am squeezing into tiny little podcast rooms.
Do you like the new podcast room?
It's cozy and the fabric of Peter's pants is brushing up against my knee.
That was what we always thought was missing from the old podcast room was that we weren't physically pushed together.
Our intimacy was purely intellectual, and now it's tactile
as well. Right.
I mean, when we started to sweat, it took a few seconds for that aroma to sort of waft over to
And you really had to shake your head to get the droplet spray on the rest of us. Now it's just rivulets. It's just a matter of time.
It's just constant.
But it is great. In all seriousness, to be back here.
Wonderful to have you back.
Yes, indeed.
I jumped at this opportunity for brand awareness.
Yeah, when your agent reached out, we were like, yeah, let's have him in. We'll negotiate the fee later.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people say on the phone, it just sounds like my agent, Beverly, is just me with a high-pitched voice. She gets that a lot, Beverly.
Your helicopter was larger than I thought it would be, and I'm so glad we were able to land it on the roof.
Yeah, I'm glad. It's one of those transforming helicopters. It turns into a 2000 Honda Civic with the press of a button.
Easier to get past the zoning intricacies that way.
Right. And great for Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah.
So, well, I mean, you haven't been on the podcast in a while, so, I mean, it seems like the best thing to do would be to say, what have you been doing?
Yeah.
What have you been up to?
I have been freelance writing around various outlets.
Any recent / current things that listeners need to check for?
Video game related.
You and I have something in the works.
Oh, yeah.
We don't talk about this.
Oh, yeah, true.
Look for an interesting, I don't want to say the outlet yet, but look for a very, very interesting, I hope the story is interesting. The topic is very interesting, specifically about the cosplay scene around games, sort of, you know, the ways in which it's like inhabiting an avatar in a game and sort of the overlap between the fandoms. I'll let you know when that goes live.
Okay, that's cool.
Heady.
Indeed.
Mm. What you been playing? I think that's the question, really.
What have I been playing? What haven't I been playing? Well, I haven't been playing a lot because I'm not on all the PR mailing lists like I used to be. But I have been playing. I've been playing this great iOS game called 80 Days by Inkle, and it's mostly text, but it's based on Around the World in 80 Days, a Jules Verne book. It casts you as Passepartout. And you know you've got to manage the money and the bags that you know you're taking on the journey around the world. But what's great about it is you know you're managing resources. You've got to hawk the heavy woolens for, you know, tropical wear, and but it's just a story. Like every town you get to, like some adventure, and it's like, it's because it's text, the story can really branch a lot. So that is great.
Nice.
I've been playing the Angry Birds Transformer game, which is just, I always like to check in because they are at the absolute cutting edge of that, you know, Skinner box, you know, fishing line with 8 hooks and 12 pieces of bait. And this is just the craziest one they've ever done.
I thought you were about to say they are at the absolute end of their rope and trying to find a way to squeeze the stone a little harder.
If only. But, you know, 3 different types of currency and everything, you know, has respawn times and spend money to speed through it. And what I really love is you can spend extra money to play Angry Birds Transformers Jenga and use your Autobot to break blocks. And I'm like, it's just, it's beyond parody at this point, just the brand mashups. But finally, I'll just say very quickly, Lucas Pope, is that his name?
Oh, yeah, Lucas Pope.
The Papers, Please guy?
Yeah.
He's just released just a couple days ago the demo for his new game, Return of the Obra Dinn.
Not even demo. Like, he just sort of released the work-in-progress version that doesn't have game saving in it.
Yeah,
and you can really mess around a lot with it, apparently.
Very tiny vertical slice. Yeah. And normally this is like, it's kind of like when we were IGF judges and we saw that early build of Fez in 2008.
Right.
And, you know, I almost warned people against seeing it, but the art style is just so amazing.
What's the name?
The Return of the Obra Dinn. The idea is that the Obra Dinn is this ghost ship. It's like about 200 years ago. It's just returned to port with nobody on board. And you are the East India Company's insurance assessor. And you've got to go on board and figure out what happened. And you're armed with this device called the Memento Mortis. And it's just a stopwatch with a death's head. And you open it. When you come across the you know, bleached bones of a dead body, you open it. And you see the moment of that person's death. You see, you know, you hear, you know, the last couple of phrases they heard or they said, and then you see just freeze frame the moment of their death. And you've got to piece together exactly what happened to each person on this ship. And that's pretty interesting. But, you know, what's amazing is just the art style. I've never quite seen anything like it. And it's really hard to do an original retro art style in 2014. But this just absolutely nails this
Macintosh hypercard look, right?
Yeah. It's like those early Apple II, early PC, just when the text adventure games were starting to try and add some graphics and, you know, but everything was totally monochromatic and you could just use, you know, a slab of black or slab of white or lines of varying length and dots.
And not even shades
density.
Of gray.
Yeah.
Like black or
white. Black or white. And it just nails that look. And actually, you know, I would warn against, you know, I would tell you to wait till the final release, but this just isn't gonna show up well on, you look at the YouTube clip and it sort of takes off that dithery, like pointillist art style, which is, and actually the art style, you know, it adds this nice sort of, it feels like doubly retro. It kind of looks like an illustration from a 200-year-old book, you know, that kind of lithographic
thing. Okay.
But it also looks like just the dawn of PC text adventure, you know, graphical adventure games. And it's great because, like, when you are going back in time to the moment of a person's death, you know, if they just pointed, you know, the pistol at their head and blew their brains out, and you're seeing that moment, and it's like a frame from, you know, the JFK Zapruder film, it's kind of a good thing that it's so abstract and monochromatic.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really amazing little just snapshot of this game in progress.
Yeah, that's cool. Very cool. And props to him for, you know, just kind of throwing it out there and saying, hey, take a look at what I'm doing. The new face of...
And not even give me $15 for the
early
alpha,
access.
You know,
just like here,
it's just out there. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Okay, well, that's cool. Yeah. I really got to... I do want to check that out. I think I'm going to spoil myself and... Yeah.
And he just made that available for download, or is it?
Yeah, it's just through itch.io.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Anything else you've played?
I'm playing some of the Disney Fantasia Kinect game.
Yeah. Well, which I played a million demos of because they've been demoing it for like 2 years.
Didn't we see that last year at E3?
Two E3s in a row. Yeah. Well, it got super delayed.
Right.
Which I think was my take was that it was just Microsoft just pushing it back because they wanted it for the holiday season. And so they just had to sit on it for a long time.
And yet now they just dump it on the market with zero fanfare and zero promotion.
Yeah, well, because they're more done with Kinect than consumers are done with Kinect at this point. Like, they just don't want to talk about it.
And, it's like the cycle I go through with every Kinect game. I start playing it, and I'm like, oh, they finally got the controls right. You know, these controls are really tight. Uh-huh. And then I realize, no, the controls are just incredibly forgiving on the tutorial mode,
right,
like in all Kinect games. And then it starts needing more nuance and finesse, and it's just not there. Oh, it's a shame.
Yeah, I heard that because there is an Xbox 360 version also, and I heard that version was more forgiving, and the people who have tested both of them have found that they just prefer playing the 360 version because it's not as not as fastidious about your movements. Nobody, I don't want to be judged too harshly playing this game right with my hands around.
It's Conductor Hero from what I remember.
It is.
Essentially.
And props to Leopold Stokowski, I have to say. This is not like Rock Band. You've got your arms suspended in the air and you're waving them around. Yeah. After about half an hour, 45 minutes, you start to feel that.
That's
a little
right.
bit.
I hurt myself playing Samba de Amigo back in the day because I bought Samba de Amigo and I marathoned it so much that I actually hurt my arms to the point where I couldn't raise them above my head.
Occupational
hazard. I could, but it really hurt to do so. Didn't want to.
We should just do a Jaws style, Chasing Amy style, comparing injuries about games. And I squeezed my pinky and the trigger, and
I got shoulder button shoulder.
So speaking of Microsoft's holiday gaming lineup, I have actually played a whole lot of Sunset Overdrive. In fact, I can pretty much say at this point, I've played all of Sunset Overdrive. I can't talk about all of Sunset Overdrive yet, but soon, very, very soon. But I can talk about certainly the first couple hours because they actually let, as soon as Sunset Overdrive went out to reviewers, they let people stream it up to a certain mission. Unfortunately, the document that they provided, the NDA document for Sunset Overdrive, is like, it looks, it's like trying to read, it's like trying to read the part of the Bible where they just like say who gave birth to whom and parse it. Because it seems like from what people, Insomniac people were saying or Microsoft people were saying, they kept having to like go in and personally tell people that they had streamed too far. You have to stop now because it said on line 57 of this labyrinthine terms and conditions, we set out how far you can stream. So that happened, and I understand why everybody was confused, because it was a confusing document. But they also there's also this thing called Sunset TV, which as you're playing through the game, there's big widescreen displays on some of the stores, and that is going to stream a constantly updated video presentation that Insomniac will make each week. They'll make a new one talking about, I don't know if they add stuff to the game or, tips and tricks and things of that nature. But the one that they had playing, I walked up to it and looked at it, and a guy appears on the screen. And he's like, hey, welcome to Sunset TV. If you're watching this, that means you're either reviewing the game or watching somebody stream the game who's reviewing it. I don't want to tell you that you should bump up your high score, but, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that very playful, self-aware style of narrative permeates the experience. I'm on the one hand, it's like I don't actually want to play like AAA games anymore that aren't at least aware that they're just sort of recycling the same things over and over and over again. I almost feel like if Sunset Overdrive took itself too seriously, I wouldn't have liked it as much because as much as they're clearly struggling with all of these tropes of AAA video games, they can't move away from it because fundamentally what Insomniac is a production house for massive AAA games, right?
Sure.
So at least they can make fun of it. But they're stuck in this limbo where they see how ridiculous it is, but they're still doing it. Mm. Traversal, getting from point to point in Sunset Overdrive, is super fun.
Yeah.
And that really helps to make Sunset Overdrive super fun. It's Crackdown X Jet Set Radio.
Mm-hmm.
That Crackdown style of big open world city, but you can jump like Mario, and you can dash across the air, and you can leap up buildings. And they do build the buildings in a very, you know, interesting ways, so that there's always a way to the top. But it may involve wall running, and it may involve, you know, bouncing off things. Anything that's like a certain size, you can bounce off of it and get a huge jump off of it. And that doesn't make any sense. There's no reason why you should be able to bounce off of a bush. But it makes sense in the sense that this is a video game, and that it would have made sense in a 90s arcade game by Namco that you would have been able to bounce off of a bush. So it makes sense here. That really sort of joyous, we're not trying to be realistic attitude. And just, you never want to be walking on the ground because that's where all the enemies are, and they will kill you.
And it takes longer to kind of compound your multipliers when you're on the ground.
Right. So they want you to be constantly grinding rails, grinding telephone lines, bouncing off of bushes, wall running and air dashing and stringing those things all together so you can make your way across the city very, very quickly and never touching the ground. Doing those things gives you style points, and you only really make a dent in enemies if your style is up.
Right.
So if you stand on the ground, not only are you a stationary target and are thus going to get wailed on, you're not going to do that much damage if you try to play this game like Gears of War.
Right.
And so that's the great thing. And, you know, it certainly works out where you don't have to... if they had done this but then not penalized you for staying on the ground, people would have stayed on the ground and said this game is boring. Mm-hmm. So they penalize you for going down there, and they make you grind on rails while you're in battle. So, of course, it totally changes how the game feels, because you're shooting things, but it doesn't feel like a typical game battle where you're shooting things, because it's like they set up all of these, you know, for all the set piece battles, they set up telephone lines and things like that are you know, sort of connected in circles all around where the battles end up being. So it's like Tempest.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like it doesn't feel like, you know, third person shooter video game. It feels like all these other weird things all going on at the same time. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to discuss that happens after that sort of arbitrary, you know, preview cutoff point, which I certainly will in due time. But I think if you are watching people stream the game and enjoy it, you know, you're seeing that it's definitely that first chunk is it gets off to a really nice start.
And I think tonally, too, you know, it was one of the first games that Microsoft showed at Xbox One's first E3.
Yeah.
So two E3s ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the one for me that immediately jumped out. And it, from the little bit that I've played, while the art style has changed just a tiny bit from the original reveal, like that brashness is intact, and the humor in it is intact. And it, you know, my fear was that it would go into kind of Poochie the Dog overkill land.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, it rides that line, but it knows it's doing it.
What was that, the Tony Hawk X or something?
Oh.
Tony Hawk, when they tried to be really punky.
Yeah. Right, right.
You didn't want that.
Oh, American Wasteland?
That was the
that
one.
It?
Yeah, I just like I saw a reel of the Respawn animations, and they're so funny and wild,
and
it kind of had a Borderlands vibe to me.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, just the art style instantly tells you that this is distinctive, and it's just winking at you a little bit, and it's, you know, it really made me want to play it.
Yeah.
Yep. And that is their big, it's interesting holiday season. It's that, yeah, it's that sort of depressed first post-launch Christmas, mm-hmm, where I think if you look back in terms of history, like at 2006 for the Xbox 360, 2007 for the PS3, and now for the Xbox, mm-hmm, One, PS4, it's like there's games, mm-hmm, but they're it's not that exciting. And this is probably going to be, this is the trough. This is like their least exciting holiday season. Sunset Overdrive is, you know, it's good for Microsoft that it's working out as strong as it is, mm-hmm, because it's like Sunset Overdrive and a Halo collection,
yeah,
and
yeah,
that's, you know, in Fantasia, and like that's their holiday. That's for Sony, it's even worse. It's like Little Big Planet 3 and Drive Club, and that's their holiday. Meanwhile, Nintendo, ooh, benefits from being in year 3, which is Smash Brothers, and Captain Toad, which I have always, right, said is the best game of the holiday season, all and Hyrule Warriors and Bayonetta, mm-hmm, 2. You know,
I mean, is Borderlands too early to be?
Oh, I mean, I'm not talking about things that aren't exclusive. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so right now, the thing that's kind of helping out, well, Borderlands, the pre-sequel is
that's gen 360.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Which would that surprised me?
Yeah, me too.
Greatly.
That seems like a messed up.
Yeah, but even the things that are next gen are not entirely. Like Shadow of Mordor is also, right, on current gen. Right. A lot of things are also current gen.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know. I mean, install, yeah, but there are 150 million PS3s and, yeah, Xbox, right, 360s.
So almost, is LBP so. 3 PS4 exclusive?
PS4 exclusive.
It's not. That seems. Judging from like the family friendliness, mm-hmm, and the legacy of PS3 install base, like it seems like they would sell so many copies of that to PS3 owners.
I don't know. I mean, maybe they would, and maybe they just don't want to deal with making a PS3 game at this point.
Right,
or
right.
Or maybe it's coming. Maybe it shows up before the end of the fiscal year, some point in March. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this one, it's not Media Molecule, right?
Or is it? I believe that you are correct that it is not Media Molecule.
I think. I would be very keen to see what they're up to.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yep.
I also love Little Big Planet games.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah, it's tough to make that your key holiday, yep, release for your
I mean, it's
really hardcore gaming oriented platform too.
Yeah, that's, yep, true.
Yep. So yeah, weird kind of holiday season.
Yeah.
You know, boosted by the fact that the third party games that are coming out are generally getting pretty good reviews, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
But you know, the good games aren't exclusive. The exclusive games aren't so good. It's kind of weird. Yeah.
You know. We're definitely, I think, you know, witnessing. You know, this is a result of the enormous development budgets now. It seemed like,
yeah,
right,
it seemed like last gen, even when we're starting to see the effects of this, but there were still, you know, some quirky, weird games that were, you know, not indie games. They were going there in boxes to stores, and but yeah, it just seems to be big AAA flagship, mm-hmm, stuff. And that's, yeah, well, that's how things are going, for, right, sure.
Yep. Oh, this is, okay, slight change of subject, but this is really interesting. This has been kind of occupying my mind because I wasn't able, due to the new baby, to go, mm-hmm, to the Portland Retro Video Game Expo, mm-hmm, which I always go to. It was over last weekend. And what I did not realize would happen is that it was apparently just completely insane. Really? They went from, I think it was like 5,000 attendees maybe last year. They went to like 8,000. Line wrapped around the building to get in, hmm, for like the early bird hour. Tons and tons of people went. Somebody on Twitter said that the band Hanson was there. I don't actually know if that's the case or not.
That's what they attributed the surge in popularity.
No, it was just, it seems like we've now hit that perfect storm, yeah, of, well, the Portland Retro Gaming Expo has quickly been becoming the big one. Like, people, mm-hmm, travel there because it's so big. There were I mean, there's a huge, like, classic arcade, but then there's also, like, 200 vendors, you know, doing retro game and related stuff, which is a pretty huge amount. Like, that's basically become the West Coast's premier retro gaming expo. But that was, you know, it was a big fish in a small pond for a while, but that pond is getting bigger. And so it seems like this year the popularity of, like, video game collecting, YouTube shows, things like that, is kind of reached fever pitch with this particular expo because apparently it was nuts. And I mean, a lot of the, you know, I know a lot of the vendors, and they were just like, I didn't get to sit down. Like, typically, like, even last year, we went, like, I had a table, I was selling, like, doubles for my collection, and you'd be able to, you know, it would slow down, you'd be able to get up, walk around, buy stuff from other people, come back to your table. My friends who went this year, the table that I would have been at with my friends who were local, are just like, you know, just fellow collectors, not me, like a game store or anything. They were just like, couldn't leave the booth. Huh. We could not leave the booth. There were times when, you know, my friend, his girlfriend, and my other friend, and then my other friend were all at the booth, all talking to different people who were all buying different things all at the same time. Like, they were just like, it was madness.
So was this
people were just destroyed.
So is this a bubble, or are the prices justifying?
That is an excellent question that people keep asking. Like, are we right now in a bubble where there's tons of collectors and they're all going to bail out all at the same time and the prices are going to go down? So I have no idea. I mean, I know that it's not a Beanie Babies type thing where the tie company just continues to make Beanie Babies. Yeah, like, there's no, people can't get fatigued in that way because that's what happened with comic books, right? Yeah. It happens with collectibles where people feel the need to keep buying the new things that come out, and then they all en masse are just like, whoa, people are exploiting us too much. Yeah. I don't have the money to buy all this stuff. The old stuff didn't gain the value that I thought it was going to, and everybody thinks to themselves at the same time, I'm out. And the prices come down a little, and then everybody else is just like, well, prices are coming down, time to get out, and then it crashes, right? So in this case, this stuff really is rare. You know, it actually is really hard to find. I mean, I don't necessarily want the value of my stuff to go up.
Physical copies are hard to find.
Physical copies are hard to find. So, I mean, we are seeing the exit, I would think, of people who just want to play the games because there's other ways to do that, whether or not you want to download ROMs or just buy them on Virtual Console. But at the same time, you know, it's just a question of, like, what if these YouTube shows keep getting more popular? What if people keep collecting more? You know, as people stop having as many children as they have had in the past and have more disposable income and keep, you know, it's like, what happens to this collectibles market, especially as video games, physical video games, keep going away.
Exactly. Yeah. These just become more and more potent as talismans.
Right.
You know?
I mean, even the, you know, when it was, we almost got to the case where a disc on the Xbox One was meaningless, you know, because it was just the data, and you had to enter in the code to be the one
security code.
If that does eventually happen, you know, the idea of owning these games that you can just play for as long as you want, whenever you want, it starts to become, it doesn't have to be a huge mainstream thing. It just has to attract enough kind of dedicated collectors. You know, the comic book market crashed, but Action Comics number one just sold for a record price. Right. So there's two different things. Yeah. So that happened. Thing number two that happened that is absolutely related to this is Daniel Feit, who writes for us, just surfaced he found a Japanese blog in which some Japanese gaming collectors were talking about something that I've been hearing about, haven't witnessed yet for myself, but want to go check this out at my earliest convenience. Akihabara getting kind of cleared out of stock. You know, you used to be able to go to Akihabara and it was just every video game ever was there, and they'd have tons of stuff. Now it's the stock is really getting drained. And they were talking about, like, it's all these foreigners coming in. They buy all the games and they take them away to their home country. And there was actually one of the major game stores in Osaka called Game Tantadan, their official Twitter account, one of their employees jumped in on the account to start talking about this. And he was like, this is all really fascinating. He's like, you know, we've always had, you know, foreigners coming to our stores, buying stuff. But, like, just in the last 1 to 2 years, we've seen a huge uptick of people coming in. anything where you don't need to know the language to play it, you know, action games mm-hmm. and shooters, you know, masterpieces, like really, you know, well-known games, those are getting bought in huge quantities. It's just like, it, you know, this was coming from a guy who either owns or, you know, works at a store. He was telling people, like, if you're thinking to yourself, one day I'll buy this game, like, I would really recommend that you just buy it now. Like, yeah. because it's all... And the thing is, it's like it's flowing out, but it's not flowing yeah. back in. You know, people are buying stuff, taking back to their country, and it's related because people are starting to realize, oh man, the prices of Super Nintendo games are going so high. So instead, I'll collect Super Famicom games because you can buy a complete in-box Super Famicom game with beautiful artwork. You know, usually better than the American artwork for the price of a loose. You know, copy of that game on Super mm-hmm. Nintendo, right? You can buy Final Fight 2, you know, for like $20, but the game that same game boxed on the Super Nintendo would cost you like $100. So you start it starts clicking over in people's minds, like, I'll just buy Japanese games. And so mm-hmm. now there's big sellers of Japanese games on eBay because Japanese sellers typically didn't use eBay because they mm-hmm. didn't want to deal with a language barrier and shipping things overseas. It was all just all prior to now, it was just on the merry-go-round of Japan, and the games would just yeah. circulate from person to person. Somebody would buy it, they'd build up a whole collection, they'd sell their whole collection back to a store, and then somebody else would buy it piece by piece, but now it's going out, but it ain't coming mm-hmm. back in. And so it, even to the point where Japanese collectors are starting to notice it, and it's like, where are games going?
Yeah, so my mother had the antique bug, and
yeah.
and like in the late 90s, early 2000s, she said you could kind of see, you know, different types of antiques and stuff. People would begin to discover eBay, yeah. and you know there would be transparency, and there would just be increasingly tiny. You know, people would go to more and more rural places trying to find people who didn't know. Well, maybe I should look online and see what this is worth. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, there would be just perfect transparency, and you would know. You know,
right.
And that seems to be maybe that's what's happening in games now. Mm-hmm. There's just a worldwide, you know, the
yeah.
shipping cost
yeah, totally.
is only going to be so much, and you know, people in from the Netherlands are bidding against people from Osaka, are bidding against people from Milwaukee now
right.
for the same.
Yeah. Why audience. Not just right? Why not just buy it directly from Japan versus somebody yeah. you know marking it up? Right. Right. Exactly. And again, you have people of all income levels getting into this. You know, you have people who only have a small budget on, you know, spending on stuff, mm-hmm. but they'll do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take. You know, it doesn't take that much of a price rise of your own sort of the stuff that was produced or the stuff you had when you were a kid. You know, that goes up in price. You're yeah. going to shift over to the next thing.
Yeah.
And you know, again, I think my friend said he had a bunch of like random like Saturn games from Japan and was surprised at how quickly people bought them. You know, and that's not something that's been very popular with U.S. collectors,
right.
you know, but it scratches that collecting itch anyway, you know, to shift over into something else. I've been buying magazines. I've been buying like old issues of Electronic Games, that mm-hmm. first video game magazine, because it's just, you know, it's just enjoyable.
Yeah.
The act of collecting, of like, okay, I'm going to make a list, and mm-hmm. what do I have? What do I not have? You know, how much are these worth? What's a deal? What's not a deal? It's like I can do it with gaming magazines and be kind of into it, versus looking at games, which are just like, yeah, I can do the same thing, but the, you know, the amount of money I'd be spending would be
yeah.
crazy. And so, yeah, and then, you know, to your point about the bubble, it's like, is it a bubble or is this the new normal? Or, you know, when the bubble pops, how far down do they go and yeah. what happens?
I mean, so there's two things. One is there's legitimate scarcity, like you said. This isn't like
right.
comic books releasing chrome variant covers
yeah.
in the 90s trying mm-hmm. to capitalize. But then you also and built into that is there is an end at which kind of an endpoint in console history at which scarcity is no longer an issue.
Yeah.
Right. And who knows if it's two generations back or three generations back or what have you. But the question then is the people who are new to this or who are paying inflated prices, anything that causes the appearance of a bubble, if someone feels burned, if prices drop and enough people feel burned, then it's not about reselling their collection. right?
If then prices that, drop and enough people feel burned,
then they're not even going to try to redistribute those assets and create kind of a ground zero again where a marketplace can again thrive.
Right.
It's basically not, these things are gone.
Mm-hmm.
So scarcity is back up.
Yeah.
But those things aren't going to be recovered anymore. So you're effectively, like in Japan, taking away from the permanent stock that gets distributed among collectors. So like if there's a bubble and it crashes, it kind of counterintuitively creates more rarity and more scarcity and many more games that you're never going to find. So it kind of has this odd counterintuitive detrimental.
Yeah. Like prices go down, but the availability...
It kind of freezes the entire marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's all... It kind of all boils down to the intentions of the people who are leading this. The extra 3,000 people at
Portland Retro Games. And what is it that they want?
What are your intentions with my...
That is very, very true and interesting. Like, these... The sort of... You know, newcomer collectors, like how dedicated are they? Why do they want these things? And what are they going
to
do with them?
Because it's very easy to imagine them getting a few things, tiring of this.
Yeah.
And then just like throw them in a box or throw them away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the ease with which people consign stuff to the landfill pile at this point kind of bodes badly for the future of that particular collecting market.
It could be. Like, who knows what ends up happening with them. But, I mean, Baker, to your point about, you know, transparency, I mean, that's, you know, the as soon as people started, you know, people can, anybody can easily figure out what things are worth. And so you can still go to garage sales and you can find somebody selling a big box of Nintendo games for, like, $10. But... The odds are very good that you are not going to do it, because the odds are very good that somebody who resells games for a living showed up there at 5 a.m. and bought them all before you got there.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a big thing that I talked about at the one of my Penny Arcade Expo panels, was just like, you have to don't just do things that don't work to build your collection. Like, if you're going to garage sales at noon, you know, and you're in a, you know, major area, and they... If that garage sale advertised video games, somebody already went there and bought all the good ones. Mm-hmm. So you're just wasting time. Like, do something else. Don't do it and then complain that, you know, the reseller got everything. It's like, you have to shake up what it is you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, fascinating to hear about these kinds of things happening. Yeah. I can't believe it took this long for Akihabara to start really getting, like, you know, massively cleared out. But collectors, game collectors tend to be... all things being equal, tend to be ethnocentric. They tend to want the games that they grew up with in their country.
Though, I will say the Japanese collectors of American music are completely flipped around.
Oh, interesting.
Like, you see the loving reissues of jazz and blues and old field recordings, and kind of that... You know, the Japanese import versions of those albums are so much more lovingly done and so much more valuable that there's this... I mean, I think that you... And I don't know if the U.S. is... because of its musical legacy or whatever, I think you see that with, with in Europe as well. Like, the people who know the most about American musical history tend to be European and Japanese. It's just... That is, you find someone writing critical essays about jazz and blues, chances are they're Dutch or they're Scandinavian or they're Japanese. You know, and that HBO show Tremé, I think, flicked at that. This is a show kind of about New Orleans post-Katrina, and so, a Japanese music collector came and kind of knew this guy's entire... discography, and the guy was like, no one here has ever heard of me. How do you know this stuff?
Oh,
And like paying top dollar for recordings, but I do think that there is, it's a completely flipped around thing where with games, you're recreating, it's childhood nostalgia. It's the games that you grew up with, whereas maybe for some other art forms, it's about reaching past that. And I wonder, too, as video game history continues and the evolution of the form and continues, you're going to see collectors born in the 2040s who are questing for Xbox One.
Whatever it ends up being.
It's got to be pre-digital, right? Because those assets will, in some ways,
the only way to... Yeah.
Yeah, but...
And you'll be able, I mean, I'm sure that people will, well, you know, I don't want to be too positive about this sort of stuff, but, you know, I'm sure people work to preserve the games that are coming out digitally now, mm-hmm. and, okay. you know, the guys who would make emulators back in the day will be making, you know, those sorts of people will be making similar things. You can go back and play these old Xbox Live Arcade games that were, you know, long delisted, mm-hmm. and they found it on somebody's console, and they spread it around. I mean, that will be the next,
yeah.
you know, there was a time, I do remember a time before all of the NES ROMs were available, you know, and some of them were bad dumps. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that, you know, Frank Cifaldi, like, you know, one of the things that he was doing back in the day was like
lost levels, yeah.
tracking down yeah. released NES cartridges mm-hmm. and actually getting good dumps of them mm-hmm. so they could continue to build the full library and have it done. So, you know, the Frank Cifaldi of tomorrow is going to be hunting down Double Dragon for Xbox Live Arcade,
finding
a console that has it installed and pulling the data off mm-hmm. of that and making that available for everybody. And, you know, if it's not that, it'll be something else is tracking down those things. Or, you know, versions yes, of games.
Absolutely.
Pre-update swing copters, you know, mm-hmm. so people can actually experience what people were talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Which sounds like a much, much more difficult and time-consuming yeah. and pain in the ass process than finding old Nintendo cartridges.
Well, it's like looking for master tapes. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just you look into them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like that Chubby Checker demo tape that was only yes. unearthed recently yeah. with him singing the Dig Dug song. You look into
the
stuff.
The perfect intersection of what we've been talking about.
Yep.
I had that on loop for about a week. I just could not stop listening to that.
It was wonderful. Incredible. Yeah. So, I talked about Fantasy Life last week, yep. right? Yeah, yep. The Nintendo 3DS role-playing game. Ago. Oh, okay. Two weeks ago. Last week?
It was 2 weeks ago.
Wow. Okay, well, I talked about Fantasy Life yeah. before. Okay, so I don't really have much more to say about it. What I talked about last time yeah. still sums up my feelings on Fantasy Life.
So next week, more on Sunset Overdrive next week.
More on Sunset Overdrive next week, for sure. Yep. Baker, anything else you've been doing?
Outside of games.
Oh, I guess. Okay.
There is a world outside of games? I don't understand. Like the Amish?
There is, so 3D Realms, I just got an email today that mm-hmm. 3D Realms is selling a bundle of, it's like 20 games?
Yeah. And it's like everything?
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. And I think it's going to be $40 for the whole bundle.
$20.
First two what? Days is $20.
Oh,
and then
first 2 days.
Up.
Okay. But it's like Commander Keen and everything yeah. that Apogee/3D Realms has the rights to. Mm-hmm. But this is the 3D Realms that is now owned by Interceptor Entertainment. Right. Although apparently Scott Miller is still somehow involved, mm-hmm. I guess. I don't know. I can tell you the lawsuit between 3D Realms and Interceptor and Gearbox over that announcement of that Duke Nukem game mm-hmm. continues apace. I believe that they've... there's been court filings, you know, yeah. back and forth, no major movements, but it may go to trial still. I mean, who knows? That mm-hmm. would be very interesting if that were to happen, but doesn't seem like there's a definitive answer yet, yeah. On whether or not, it kind of comes down to this fundamental question of who owns the copyright and trademark and rights to Duke Nukem, mm-hmm. you know, did 3D Realms transfer everything yeah. to Gearbox, or did the agreement that they signed still leave 3D Realms with some right that essentially lets them introduce this Duke Nukem game that they had introduced? I just found it hilarious that they took this message about the game and just like converted it into like essentially wingdings that were like incredibly yeah. easily decoded yeah. by someone. Yeah.
Those bundles are just They're terrible. And I realized I now approach Steam like a hardcore retro game collector. Uh-huh. You know, I've got this enormous wish list. And like System Shock 2, $2.99. Well, yeah. You know, I don't want to play that. I probably won't play it at any point in the near future, mm-hmm. but I'll just add it to the stockpile.
Yeah,
I'll add it to my archive.
I'm that way with Humble Bundles that there's a game in there that I know I already have. I might have two copies of it digitally, but I just, those are, it's so difficult for me to resist those things. Yeah.
Business idea.
Yeah.
Selling those redundant copies somehow. Extracting your digital right to them. Yeah. And,
I guess you can sell them on Steam if you have an extra copy, can't you? No, you can only gift.
I think with some of these, if you're buying a copy of a game you already had, there's some mechanism by which you can transfer ownership of that extra copy.
You gift for under the table a certain amount of hats. And then you find an exchange in Hungary.
Yes.
Trades hats for EVE Online currency, and then you transfer that into real currency. Excuse me.
Itchy and scratchy.
I need to go incorporate right now. I've going to be a thousandaire with this idea.
I don't know. That feels like a quickie.
Yeah, I know. I know. I don't want to deprive people of
dead air.
Of their Chris Baker.
Oh yeah.
Let's see. Here's a parlor game. Do you think the Xbox One will outsell the Wii U by Black Friday?
Ooh!
Wow.
I don't know what the numbers are at this point. You know why? Because Microsoft won't announce the numbers.
Well, I know authoritatively from VG charts.
No, of course.
That they're still about 2 to 2.5 million console deficit for whatever that means. We don't know what that means.
To Wii U.
Wii U is still out in front, and that is
that's for the year or that's lifetime.
That is lifetime.
Yeah,
okay. That's pretty inarguable, but it's just a question of how close it is,
and when does overlap?
When does, and that will be kind of the sorting out. Then the numbers, the total sales numbers, will really reflect what this generation is, what kind of the first, second, and third place is.
So what happens?
The question is, Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like. Yeah. Does Smash Brothers inspire enough interest in the Wii U to kick sales to the point where it can actually stay ahead of Xbox One? But I sincerely do not think so.
It's to my mind, it's either they might stave it off until December, it's at some point in the next couple of months. Xbox One is going to move into second place.
And my question is going to be, how will we know? We'll only know once Microsoft announces a number. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you Microsoft is not going to put out a press release saying, hey, everybody, we just passed the Wii U.
Number two.
That's not going to happen. So, I mean, it's just going to be, they'll be like, oh, we just sold X number of Xbox Ones in America. And then we'll be able to compare that to what Nintendo has sold. And like, see, they've passed them. But then, of course, people will still point out that, you know, has it passed it worldwide yet? No. Then that'll be the next thing.
Indeed.
And it's really more of a reflection on Microsoft's own poor showing versus Nintendo doing particularly well. That it's lagging behind in that way. But it is interesting. I absolutely did not think it would take this long for Xbox One to pass Wii U.
And is this really all rooted in those PR missteps at the beginning, pre-launch?
No, it's rooted in the fact that it was $100 more for what people perceived as less value.
Right.
You could just get a PS4 for $400, and they bumped the price down, and so that's done a good job for them. But yeah.
I maintain, the original PlayStation had a 70% market share. Mm. PlayStation 2 had a 75% market share.
Yeah.
I mean, they just had to not screw up eight different ways. And that classic brand preference is kind of reasserting itself, I think.
Yeah, could be. It could that could very well be the case. But I mean, with PlayStation 4, they didn't just not screw up. I think they had a great laundry list of things people were really excited about. Who's been playing Gaikai?
Yeah?
No one's been playing Gaikai. No, it costs like $1 million to buy one of those games on Gaikai. I haven't heard anything. I mean, since they launched the PlayStation Now beta, I really haven't
Yeah,
I haven't heard very much about it. I don't know what people are, how people are using it or anything.
Well, Josh
like that.
Got a PlayStation Vita TV.
Oh yeah.
So yep. he's been trying to stream from his house.
Oh yeah. To right. The office. Right. Right. But that's just
right. Not Gaikai. Like,
not
just,
Gaikai.
Yeah, that's
right.
Slinging
right.
his own games, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think you know it's going to have to take somebody taking the plunge and you know drastically discounting a game and you know finding the actual price point that the market will bear.
Yeah.
And then sure. Yeah, and you know who knows if they even get to that point, you know, there's
right.
Or
well, I mean again, if you're only charging X amount mm-hmm. of money to stream the game but it costs you X plus whatever to yeah. you know pay for it, to you know pay for the servers and everything, then doesn't really matter that people are streaming your games a lot.
And, you know, they held the line on price parity between physical copies and digital copies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now people are actually shelling out that equivalent price for the convenience and not having to go to the store. So
that's right. That's
they,
right.
They might be telling themselves, you know, it's a good thing we didn't, you know, certainly a lot of people in the media were saying you should be paying less because it's not a physical object.
Right.
There's no cost of reproduction. But. So yeah, who knows if that day ever comes when they hit like an actual viable price point for the Gaikai stuff.
Right. And Nintendo said they sold a you know great deal of copies of you know Hyrule Warriors mm-hmm. and Super mm-hmm. Smash Brothers on 3DS as downloads. Although again, it's still nowhere near, you know, it's not even a 50-50 split. Yeah, it's like more like 80-20 at best.
But you know that's 80-20 when 100% of that money goes to you.
Right, right.
So you got to figure in, I've seen figures anywhere from like 60 down to 30%, you know, for even you know, that a publisher would get back on a sale through a retail.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, you're talking, it's a lot closer than that when you factor that in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100% of the money going directly to the
going just $60 getting deposited in your bank account if you're Nintendo minus the 25-cent credit card transaction fee, right? Versus having to sell the game wholesale for $30.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Plus that then minus the cost of manufacturing, so you're only exactly. Yeah.
We're getting there.
They have every incentive in the world to get to a situation where they can just sell the hardware in stores and just sell you the games through the download store. And they're even taking a little bit of a hit on some of the downloads because they'll sell the download code in GameStop. So it's like, oh, GameStop, you know, you buy these download codes from us printed on these little cards, and then you buy them from us in bulk, and then you sell them at retail. And they're fine with that because then it gets GameStop on board with, transitioning over. And it's funny because it's like asking GameStop to sell anti-GameStop pills, which is kind of strange if you think about it, but at this point, GameStop, I think, sees the writing on the wall anyway. Yeah. So they're like, yeah, whatever. Doesn't really matter what we do. Our business is going away, so we got to figure out what the replacement is. A local Goodwill store in, I want to say, North Carolina opened up a retro gaming branch.
Awesome.
Just a store that sells classic games that were donated to Goodwill.
Does it ever have anything in stock? Just because people just go in every day and sweep it out.
Oh, it's not cheap. It's not inexpensive.
Wow.
It's not a. Never said it was a thrift store. Everything is, you know, eBay prices or above, basically. Yeah. But they have a bunch there. They had a bunch of stuff in there when I saw that people had gone in.
Mm. Yeah. I wonder if that's, you know, well, we see people, you know, the wife forces them to liquidate their collection, and it's actually a better option tax wise to just Goodwill it and write the whole thing down.
Oh, sure, yeah. it could be. I don't know.
Yeah, then you can list at value, right? You can list at what it would fetch. Like that would be
I believe
eBay price,
so. Yeah,
what you, yeah,
right.
That's a nice deduction.
Any accountants listening, if you could send us a detailed disquisition on the tax benefits of, yeah.
Yep. It all goes at some point. Either you sell it or you die, and your next of kin sells it.
I said, what the hell is this?
Can't take it with you. I think that was pretty much a podcast.
I think so. I think that qualifies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Baker, it was lovely having you here again.
Oh, it was great to see you guys again. And yeah, again, don't let anyone tell you that I came here to promote Angry Nerd Wired.
Uh-huh.
That's Angry Nerd Wired, all one word, mm-hmm. on Twitter, on Vine. On Instagram.
Is the Vine?
On Google Plus.
Is Vine just 6-second clips of the show? Or is it you, like, you are making your own 6-second tiny rants by yourself?
So far, it's just 6-second clips I've pulled from the show. But yeah, I'm. I just posted a 6-second review of Ouija.
And yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And, like, I want Angry Nerd yelling at his cereal.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Because 6 seconds is probably...
You know, it's funny you should mention that length. Because I just saw a box of Count Chocula, and General Mills has literally defanged Count Chocula.
What?
He doesn't have fangs. He has little rectangular rabbit teeth in the middle of his... Yeah.
Baloney.
Yeah, no. He's vegan vampire.
This is what I'm talking about.
There we go. See, exactly. We need you on the cereal beat.
Don't get me started.
Yes, thank you very much for being here. So again, that's Chris Baker Leet for regular Chris Baker.
Yes, and Chris Baker 1337 on Twitter. But then my alter ego, my Batman identity, is Angry Nerd Wired, all one word, on Twitter, Vine, Google Plus,
Go for Instagram. The caricature of you as an angry Smurf.
Yes.
Stay for the
invective.
Yes. And definitely subscribe to the Wired channel on YouTube and check out the videos on video@wired.com and on YouTube.
Some of which feature me personally.
It's true. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes.
Mostly just parading around in a dump.
Nothing wrong with that.
Peter.
Yes.
What do you want to plug?
I don't think I have anything with my name on it worth plugging right now. I'm plugging away on long-term stuff. But
your Twitter handle.
My Twitter handle and most of my other social media channels is Proven Self. That's ProvenSelf.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. If you're a Disney fan like me, you got to check out Wired's cover story this month, which is about Caitlin Roper's
amazing cover story.
Huge cover story. On
Big Hero 6.
Big Hero 6 and
big
Disney.
Turnaround at Disney.
How John Lasseter and Ed Catmull took Disney from... Home on the Range and Treasure Planet to Frozen and Big Hero 6 and Wreck-It Ralph and a swift turnaround and a dramatic turnaround.
That was I edited that. That was a really fun story to work on.
I bet.
Yeah.
Yep.
That was a good time.
I
forgot to tell a story. I'll tell it next week. And that's about my dog eating weed off the street. So wait for that.
Okay, all right. I can't wait for next week's episode of the Game Life Podcast.
Forgot to tell that one.
Still waiting for your dog to wake up and
stop
finding things so funny.
He snapped out of it. But we have a lot of microwave burritos I'm going to have to get rid of.
Oh, man. So that's awesome. I'm Chris Kohler. You've been listening to the Game Life Podcast, a production of us here at Wired. Find me on Twitter, Kobunheat, KobunHeat. Come and yell at me about stuff and ethics. I don't know. please don't. God, please don't.
No.
I have a family. we'll see you guys next week. Goodbye.